Today on the Rising Coaches podcast.
You know, it was honestly the best decision that I ever made from a career building standpoint. And the way I explain this is, you know, I have a great sense and understanding of how Randy runs his program. I understand what kind of separates them from other programs. But again, like that St. Mary's family, so to speak, I played in it. I've lived it. I have a great understanding. And then going to work for Bruce, honestly, was a complete 180. And what it really taught me was, you know, there's different ways to build a program.
Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches podcast. This is Adam Gordon. And today we are joined by Todd Golden, head coach of the University of San Francisco. Todd and I have a great conversation about his journey through the profession, starting as a player at St. Mary's, his time with Kyle Smith at Columbia, his experience with Bruce Pearl at Auburn, and then back to the West Coast at San Francisco, where he's an assistant before he transitioned to the role of head coach. We talk a lot about what makes each program and coach that he worked for successful, and we talk about his transition into the head coaching role and everything that comes along with it, like the amount of decisions, the stress, and how to handle success, which they certainly had a lot of in year one. Most importantly, we talk about the Coaches Coalition for Progress, which is an organization that Todd helped found just here recently in the last few months in the wake of the George Floyd murder and the Black Lives Matter movement. Todd felt compelled to take action. And so he helped create this organization, which you can find more about at their website, coachescoalitionforprogress.org. It's a great organization. Their mission is to foster community relationships and improve academic and athletic opportunities for under-resourced youth. So again, the website is coachescoalitionforprogress.org. You can donate and become a member for just $50. And all of that money, again, will go to resources for underprivileged youth. So we hope you enjoy this conversation. We hope you are compelled to donate to the Coaches Coalition for Progress. And please write us a review, subscribe to the podcast, and follow along with what we're doing at risingcoaches.com. Today's podcast is brought to you by the Rising Coaches Association, the biggest coaching tree in all of basketball. Sign up for the Rising Coaches Association now for just $120 a year and become part of our community, relationships, and development. We talk about it all the time. There's no straight lines in this profession. There's only ups and downs. You need a community that knows exactly what you're going through and has been there before to help lean on during the rough times of the industry. You need genuine relationships, not just exchanging numbers, not just meeting new people at the Final Four in the off season. You should be doing it all year round, and we provide tremendous opportunities to create those genuine relationships all through the year. And finally, development. We have so much content and so many resources so that you can work on your craft and become a better coach. Because we put such a premium and an emphasis on helping you establish new, genuine relationships, it takes all of the political BS side of the business out of the equation for you. All of that gets removed off of your plate. You can just worry about being you, making new friends in the business, and working on your craft and becoming the best coach that you can be and impacting the people that you're around on a daily basis. For more information, visit risingcoaches.com/membership
and join the biggest coaching tree in basketball today.
Todd, what's up, man? Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, man, we were just catching up a little bit and it's been too long.
Yep.
Hey, Todd, like I was doing a little research, you know, preparing for this podcast, and sure. I knew you were a good player, but I was looking at some of the numbers. I didn't realize you shot 57% from 3-point range.
that was just in conference play, I think, my senior year.
Oh, okay. I think that's still pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, it was like 46 or 47 for the year, which I'll never turn my back on that. I had a game against Gonzaga. I went 6 for 6 from three in that game, so that obviously kind of raised the bar that way. But listen, it's a lot easier to shoot a high percentage when you got a guy like Patty Mills, you know, just bringing the ball up the floor and drawing defenses. And you know, we had Omar Samhan on that team. we were loaded, and I was the beneficiary of being the fifth option, and I only took like three or four shots a game, but they generally were just wide open threes, so it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, they obviously went in. Yeah, so our last guest on the podcast was Darnell Archie, who led the country in when he played when he was at Butler. I want to say he led the country in free throw, consecutive free throw makes and 3-point percentage. So, yeah, if we put together like a shooting contest for my podcast guest.
You got some drillers coming on, man.
Absolutely. So that's what I was going to ask. Like, how would you describe your jump shot? You just said drillers. I've never heard that before. It's great.
You know, funny, I wasn't in high school. I was obviously a pretty good shooter, but really getting to St. Mary's was, you know, and playing for Randy and Kyle, you know, I really learned, the value of repetition. You know, I think we shot a ton, in practice and, you know, preseason workouts on our own. And, again, like that was really kind of my vehicle to get in the game, you know, at that level was being a guy that could really stretch the floor and occupy the help defense. And I mean, by the end of my career, I got really, really comfortable and got to the point where I was shooting the ball really, really well. So again, mainly because of my teammates, more so than myself, I wasn't out there creating my own shot a lot, but I was confident to knock it down when I had the opportunity.
Okay, you've avoided my first question. I need an adjective to describe your jump shot.
Effective.
Effective, okay. You're modest.
The best is, you know, I'll still mess around with some of my guys in practice before practice and stuff, and they all tease me because my form is not very pretty. It's, you know, as Kyle Smith would always say, I would tee it up. So I just get it up here. I'm lefty. And then it was kind of a push shot, you know. But
Derek Fisher style?
Yeah, it was a pusher, man. But it was accurate, and I'm not mad about it.
There you go. Good, good. You talked about, like, St. Mary's. You guys get a ton of reps up when you were there. I've heard, like, the first 40 minutes of practice is straight shots. Is that pretty accurate?
It was all skill, you know, for sure. And we do a lot of it here at San Francisco as well, just because I think it's something that's so important. And as coaches, sometimes we want to, you know, focus on, you know, what plays we're running or what defense we're setting up. But at the end of the day, the skill piece is just so important. If you got guys that can dribble, pass, and shoot, you become a lot harder to guard. So we spend a lot of time, we call it big, little, you know, Randy, that's, I assume, what he still calls it, where we break it down with your bigs on one side, littles on the other. And we'll do that for about 10 to 15 minutes. We'll still dribble. You know, we'll do a lot of dribbling in our practices, like skill work off ball screen and stuff like that, but also just up and down the floor. You know, we have our big guys handle it, so they're more comfortable in the games. And then we shoot a lot. You know, we probably shoot, you know, between 10 and 20 minutes a day in practice based upon what we have going on that day. And, you know, again, like, I think the more skilled your team is the better you're going to be.
Yeah, no question. Okay, we'll get back to, like, some of the things you guys do there at San Francisco and the success you've had. But kind of want to go backwards and talk a little bit about, you know, your coaching career and your journey to get to here. So after your playing career, you played professionally for a couple years.
Right.
And then joined Kyle Smith at Columbia. What year, was that his first year there, or?
So when I actually got done playing in Israel in 2010, and I actually did 2 years in the business world. I was doing marketing and sales in the San Francisco area for some sports companies, and you know, just after wearing a suit and tie to work every day, really wore me down, and started missing, you know, the team element and just company of being a part of something. And so I got to Kyle, I guess it would have been in 2012, 13, maybe, or so, right around there. And that was his third year at Columbia.
Third year. Okay. What did you, like, is there anything you learned by being, like, in the business world that you use today, like sales for sure, specifically?
Yeah. You know, the way I equate it and explain it to people is, you know, what I was doing was very similar to what we do in our world with recruiting. But, you know, in the basketball world, it's a little easier because the product that you're selling, which is, you know, scholarships in your program, they're generally a lot, the student athletes and their parents want that product, right? They want that $50,000 to $60,000 scholarship, where in my previous profession, when I was selling ad space on TV or digital, you know, a lot of the times the companies had no interest in it. So that I would get a lot of no's and get rejected quite a bit. But you know, the operational side of college basketball, I feel like, being in that business world for 2 years helped me quite a bit with that. Because, you know, there's a lot of intelligent people in the college basketball world, but they didn't have that real life experience in terms of, you know, just selling advertising or, you know, being a part of a sales team or, you know, that in office type atmosphere. And it definitely helped me a ton, you know, just being able to apply all of those things to our basketball world. And, you know, I was director of basketball operations twice in my career as well, which I think really helped me understand what it takes to build a program also.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking of like what it takes to build a program, Columbia is not a program that's historically been an Ivy League powerhouse or, you know, been super successful, but you guys really did turn that program around and have some great success. What were like the keys to that?
Yeah. You know, I think Kyle, one of the things that I respect the most about him is that he just never wavers. You know, I think his what he believes in from a basketball standpoint, and from a team building standpoint are really strong. He has a great sense of that. And to be honest, my first year with Kyle, his third year, we finished last in the Ivy League. We had a tough year. I think we went 6-8 or 5-9 or whatever. You know, I think we played 14 league games then and we finished last, and we had a ton of close games, you know, an insane amount of close games that we lost. And it would have been easy for him after that being his third year to start panicking and try to find quick fixes in terms of how to get back to the top of the league. But really what I was impressed with was just his demeanor and the way that we worked with our guys in that spring. You know, he thought, hey, we were really young. We have a lot of good talent coming back. Like, let's build off this. And we started running a little bit different offense going into that next year, but we jumped to 22 wins that next year and finished third or fourth in the Ivy League. And really we made a jump, but it wasn't that big of a difference. So it was really kind of sticking with it and not panicking. And that was something that Kyle, you know, really taught me a lot from that. It was just, hey, you know, you got to stick with your convictions. And if you know they're right, don't waver. And, you know, we started some of those games that we were losing the year before. Luck, you know, started flipping a little bit. We started winning some of those close games. And we were getting a little older, a little tougher. And my second year, which actually ended up being my last year there, I think we finished third or fourth in the league and won, you know, 22 or 23 games. I think we won a couple in the CIT or CBI, whichever event it was. And we just made a huge jump. And then, you know, obviously I left, but Kyle kept that thing going for a couple more years. And his last year, they won 25 games, which is just insane, you know, at Columbia. And to your point of that program, you know, I don't think they'd had any success, you know, since the mid to late 60s before that. And, you know, I know they've kind of taken a step back since he's left, and it just kind of speaks to how difficult that job is and how good of a job Kyle did building it up.
Yeah, what was the blueprint? A lot's been written about Kyle's, you know, affinity for and yours for analytics. Was that a huge part of, you know, your guys' blueprint to success there, or what was it?
You know, it definitely played a part. But where I thought Kyle, you know, looking back, you know, at the time I had no idea, right? I was ops my first year. I got moved up to an assistant my second. But I was just, you know, I played for Kyle at St. Mary's. I just really trusted and believed everything that he was doing. So I wasn't really asking a lot of questions, but really looking back again where he was great, you know, we had a lot of young guys on that team that first year that were good players, but they just weren't experienced yet. You know, they hadn't learned how to get through an Ivy season, you know, where every weekend you're playing back-to-back games. And so we kind of wore down and broke down towards the end of the year, but really just stuck with it. And I think that was that program piece, which I think is really important in the Ivy League, because you're not recruiting grad transfers in the Ivy League. You're not recruiting a lot of junior college players who might be able to come in and physically be ready to help right away. And instead of saying, hey, you know, these guys aren't good enough, we need to get better players in here, we have to do this, his approach was, hey, I think we have a good staff. I think we have a bunch of really good young players. Let's just stick with it. Let's build out the spring, be, you know, work really hard, and then we get them back in the fall, build it out. And sure enough, you know, it was just kind of the natural progression of our program. We were able to get good pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah, you guys certainly did. And then you go from Columbia down to the south, right? Next stop is Auburn, Alabama.
Yep.
Reunited with Coach Pearl, who you had played for Coach Pearl, Bruce Pearl, in the Maccabiah games. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, I played for him in the summer of, I guess it would be 2009. In the Maccabi games, the international Maccabi games in Israel, which, you know, looking back, and you'll appreciate this from your time in the coaching world, you know, he took a whole summer off of recruiting basically to coach us in those games, you know, missed the whole July live period to do that. And now being a head coach and understanding just how important those live periods are, I mean, that was a huge sacrifice that he made. And, you know, just the time and energy he put into that group, it really just gave me just a big love for him, to be honest, and appreciation. And so when he offered me the opportunity to come down and be his director of basketball operations at Auburn, when he got back into coaching, it was something that I was really, really excited about. And, you know, my wife and I just jumped right in to kind of go down there and try to build that program back up with him.
Yeah. And a lot of coaches, you know, will coach some international teams in the summer almost as a recruiting edge, but the Maccabi games, like you're not getting too many dudes to play in the SEC.
That was his deal for Tennessee at the time. You know, it wasn't like he was coaching the UA team, USA team, you know, and some FIBA competition, you know. And so, yeah, he did it out of the goodness of his heart. You know, his son was on the team, Steven, who's now on his staff and doing a great job at Auburn as well. And I think it was something that he really just considered a life experience that he wanted to do. And I was just proud of our group being able to win the gold. We won a really close, tough overtime game against Israel. And it was just a memory that we'll have forever.
What are some of the biggest takeaways you got from working for Bruce Pearl at Auburn?
You know, it was honestly the best decision that I ever made from a career building standpoint. And the way I explain this is, you know, I have a great sense and understanding of how Randy runs his program, because I played in his program for 5 years. You know, I was there every day. I understand what kind of separates them from other programs. And then I worked with Kyle for a total of 5 years as a coach as well. So again, like that St. Mary's family, so to speak, I played in it. I've lived it. I have a great understanding. And then going to work for Bruce, honestly, was a complete 180. And what it really taught me was, you know, there's different ways to build a program. And Bruce and Randy and Kyle are very different. And, you know, Kyle and Randy are very focused, very organized, have a great understanding of what they're going to do from the first day of practice through the first game of the season. You know, all 12 months of the year are planned. And Bruce's, he runs his program with love and enthusiasm. And you know, his attention to detail isn't at the same level. But he works incredibly hard. He's always on the road recruiting, you know, and I think for Bruce, he doesn't ever get outworked. And, you know, there's different ways to do it. I try to really be a hybrid of both those styles. I think that would be a great, if I'm ever able to achieve that, it would be a great way to coach, because again, they're both great in their own ways. And, you know, Bruce just kind of gave me an understanding of, hey, you know, you can do it this way. You know, we can do it our way in terms of just enthusiasm. I felt like guys always wanted to run through a wall for Bruce. You know, you were always going to get his players' best effort because they knew he just really cared about him. He loved him. He had him over to the house, you know, to get to know him better and just really kind of create that relationship piece. And, you know, just he just gave me another way to look at building program.
Yeah, he does get his guys to play harder than anybody and defend. What is, I mean, you mentioned the relationship piece. What else? I mean, is he on them all the time in practice? Is that the majority of what they work on or what?
A little bit. You know, I think it's, again, like in he definitely spends a lot of time coaching it, but it's hard to explain, but that, you know, it's just that the culture of his program, like first of all, it's recruiting too, right? I think like he doesn't bring soft guys into his program. And I think that's a big part of it. You know, he recruits it through high school and through AAU. But, you know, it's just his personality as well. You know, he's a great competitor. I think his coaching style and the way he communicates with his players, it really breeds confidence. It breeds belief. And guys, when they're out on the floor, you know, and especially playing in Auburn Arena now, when they have, you know, good opponents in there, they're selling out every night. These guys want to play under that spotlight in that environment. And, you know, every time he steps on the floor, you feel like he has a pretty good chance to beat good competition.
And then was the opportunity, you know, Kyle Smith gets the San Francisco job. Was that a no-brainer? Go back to your roots, your West Coast roots, and be an assistant there for him.
That was the hardest decision I've ever had to make, you know, in coaching. Because at the time, I think I just turned 30 years old, and I had gotten promoted to an assistant coach at Auburn. And, you know, we had two really tough years. You know, I think you were at Mississippi State at the time. You saw it. You know, we were struggling. We were, you know, kind of towards the bottom of the league. And, but we knew we were recruiting well. We had, you know, after that second year, we had that recruiting class coming in of Jared Harper, Anfernee McLemore. I'm trying to think who else was a part of it, but we knew we had guys coming in that were going to be able to help get us back going in the right way. So I felt, you know, it was tough to leave because we had done a lot of the heavy lifting, and, you know, years 3 through 5, we thought would be a lot more enjoyable because we'd be winning more. But, you know, when Kyle got this job at San Francisco, the way he kind of spun it to me was like, hey, let's try to build this thing up. And if we can get it going and, you know, if I'm fortunate enough to get another opportunity, you know, I'll do what I can to help you get this job. And as we know, you know, being a Division I head coach is incredibly difficult to do. So I kind of figured this would be a great path if we were able to be successful. And the other piece was, you know, I'm a West Coast guy. I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona, obviously went to college in California. Another concern was, if, you know, depending on how long I stayed down at Auburn, I just didn't want to get I didn't want to kind of build my career down south. You know, my family's out here. My wife's from Texas and her family's more on the West Coast. So just an opportunity to get back out west. My wife was actually pregnant at the time. So, you know, now we have two kids. We've been able to raise them out here closer to family. And, you know, those decisions are made with variables, you know, that are much different as you get older. You know, when you were young, like when I was at Columbia, yeah, it was easy for me to pick up and move down to Auburn. It was easy. You know, my wife and I did it quickly. But as you have kids, you know, there's a lot more things you have to think about before making moves like that.
And now, a quick break to hear from our friends at Lucio. What's up, podcast fans? I want to share some information about one of our partners, Lucio Sports. The team at Lucio has built an integrated platform of coaching productivity and player development apps that are being used by some of the best basketball programs around the globe, helping everyone from NBA champions to youth development academies. Their innovative and competitive memorization games make it so much easier for new players and staff members to remotely get caught up to speed. With animated playbooks, drill libraries, player development planning and monitoring, engaging game plans and scouting reports, predictive play drawing, their content services team, and more, Lucio Sports has got you covered. From players to coaches to support staff and executives, use Lucio Sports to securely keep everyone in your organization on the same page with simple on-demand access to your team's entire knowledge base. For more information, check out luciosports.com. That's L-U-C-E-O sports.com. And now back to our conversation with University of San Francisco head coach Todd Golden. So going back out west to San Francisco, was it a similar building process that you guys had at Columbia, or was this a little bit different?
It was a little different. The interesting thing is there was actually some really good talent in the program. You know, I think that they became, at the end of that last year before we got here, they were a little dysfunctional. And I think, you know, the team chemistry was a little off, and, you know, we had talented guys who left the program. You know, I think there was a leading scorer here the year before we got here who was a sophomore that was averaging like 19 a game. And when we got here, he just wasn't accepting of being on the right terms, which simply was just putting the team first. You know, he was really worried about himself and his touches and everything like that. And again, where Kyle is amazing, he's just confident in his conviction. He's like, hey, we're going to do this thing the right way. We're going to just really build it up with guys that are excited to be here, guys with great attitudes, guys that work hard, and see where it goes. So we didn't give ourselves, you know, big expectations that first year. But as we started working with our guys over the course of the spring and summer, we realized, like, all right, you know, we might be okay. We have some good guys that stuck around. We were able to bring in a good freshman class. We brought Frankie Ferrari back, who was sitting out at a JUCO. And we didn't know what that first year would look like, but we ended up winning 20 games and had a much better year than we anticipated. And knock on wood, we were able to kind of keep it going from that point forward.
Yeah, and defensively, you guys had three of the best defensive years, I think, in school history.
Right.
Was that any of that your bringing some of Bruce Pearl's stuff to San Francisco, or mixture of everything?
It was interesting because I did, when I was with Kyle my second year at Columbia, I did the defense, you know, because we were running the Princeton, and he coached Kevin Hubdy, who's now my associate head coach here. and then Carlin Hartman, who's now at Oklahoma. You know, all three of those guys had a great understanding of the Princeton offense. Kyle coached it at Air Force. Carlin was with Chris Mooney at Richmond, and so he had a great understanding of it. And then Kevin played for Chris at Richmond. So when I got promoted, I was like, you know, I'm not going to be able to help too much on the offensive side of the ball. You know, I'm the fourth most knowledgeable guy in regards to this offense. But we weren't very good my first year defensively at Columbia. And one thing that I talked to Kyle about was like, hey, let me implement what we were doing at St. Mary's defensively. You know, I think it was a pretty solid system, and we had tried to do it, but we didn't focus on it a lot. You know, Kyle is admittedly more of an offensive guy, and I think enjoyed coaching offense more. And so I kind of took that on, and we took a jump that second year. So now when I came back with him to San Francisco, is similar because Kevin Hubby was with him at Columbia and came back out here. So that first year as we ran the Princeton, I knew that Kevin had it way better than I understood it and way better than I could teach it and articulate it. So I coached the defense, and the one thing that I brought from working with Bruce and those guys was just the way we guard ball screens. We really like to down ball screens, and that was something that I had a much better understanding of after being down at Auburn, especially teaching kind of the three guys not involved in the initial ball screen coverage, where they're supposed to be and what their responsibilities are. And the other thing that we did really, really well, which they struggled with the year before we got here, was just defend the 3-point line. They got drilled from three the year before. They gave up a lot of attempts at a high percentage, and we did a really good job of just cutting down the amount of attempts we gave up, and did a good job defending it from a percentage standpoint, which is a little volatile, a little lucky. But the attempts we gave up were a lot less, and we just had a much better understanding of what we wanted to do defensively.
Yeah, that's great. And then obviously that success led to three really, really good years, and Kyle getting the Washington State job, as you mentioned, and then you get the call from the dugout. Was that a shock? I mean, well, you were 33, I think, right?
Yeah. You know what?
I say you were 33. That was like a year ago.
I would say it happened quickly from the standpoint of, you know, we had a good year. We kind of struggled in the year, to be honest. We kind of just, we tapered out. We got fatigued, couldn't really push through. And so we didn't know exactly if Kyle was going to have any opportunities or not. And the Washington State thing was kind of there, but it didn't seem to be moving that quickly. And then all of a sudden one weekend it kind of took off. And that's when I was like, man, like I might be in a position to get this opportunity. And, you know, Kyle was awesome and helped me get in position to get this job. And then our administration was great, whether, you know, our former AD Scott Sidwell, who's now at Penn State, I had a great relationship with him, and he put in a great word with Joe McDermott, who's my boss now, you know, just in terms of his confidence in me running a program. And that gave her the confidence, you know, along with our president, Father Paul Fitzgerald, and Charlie Cross, who's the CEO of the school. You know, they really appreciated the change in the program that Kyle and her staff had built, which was really just bringing in high character kids, obviously having success on the court, but really, and also doing really well in the classroom. You know, our kids are really intelligent. I think, you know, we got a 3.4 team GPA again this spring, and we've had a lot of continuity, both from a staff standpoint and from a player standpoint. So, you know, all of those kind of variables, along with me being, you know, a little younger and probably a lot cheaper, you know, I think those things kind of helped me be in good position to get this opportunity. And, you know, I was just fortunate that we were able to keep most of all the kids, all the student athletes in our program on board. And I kept a lot of my staff in place, and it made it so the transition was a lot smoother.
Okay. Everyone always talks about when you make that transition, all the things that you thought you were prepared for, but you really weren't.
Yeah.
Is there anything that sticks out that like right away was like, whoa, this is different?
I'll start with saying everything, you know,
right.
But it was crazy. You know, I think there's just so many things that, you know, you have to be involved with or be aware of, from a head coaching perspective. You know, like working with admissions on kids, you know, that as an assistant, you don't deal with that. But that's something that comes up. And then as a head coach, you really have a much better understanding of the budget and the operation budget of the program. You know, like as an assistant, you have an idea, but when you start meeting with your administrators and you see like, all right, here's really the numbers, especially at a program like San Francisco, that stuff matters a lot more, you know, scheduling, all these different, just parts of the program. You really have to be really good about knowing where they all stand, but also having people that are capable on your staff to, you can, so you can delegate to those guys to run with it. And that's where I'm incredibly fortunate. You know, I think going into it, I was able to get the perfect staff for me personally in terms of what I needed to have around me for us to be successful. I have a bunch of really smart guys, so I feel comfortable delegating different things to them and knowing that they're going to be able to handle it and take care of it. And it gives me the confidence as the head coach to be able to focus on other things that might need my attention. So, you know, getting a great staff is honestly the most important thing. It just gives you the freedom and flexibility to focus on things you need to. And that was the biggest thing in terms of being able to handle the things that come up. But, you know, just the thing that I had to most prepare for and most, I would say adjust to is just understanding that I am now responsible over all of these things. And, you know, if this one thing goes wrong, I have to pay attention to it. And then again, just delegating, making sure that everybody was on time and on target with what they were supposed to do.
Okay, so where was the biggest learning curve in that? Was it like, did you find yourself super stressed early on? Did you really have to focus on learning how to delegate? Like what was the growing pains?
There was definitely, you know, for the first couple of months, you're just concerned that you're doing everything you can, you know? And I think there were times where, you know, things might slip through the cracks and, you know, you're questioning, you know, what your staff's doing or how you have everything aligned. And yeah, definitely it was stressful, I would say. And you're just always on, you know, you don't get a chance to kind of step away and say, all right, I'm going to go, you know, on vacation for a week and not worry about it. You know, if I went somewhere with my wife, I was on my email at 6 a.m. and then again at 11 o'clock at night, just making sure that everything was squared away. But you become more than just a basketball coach. Like, this becomes your environment. This becomes your family, your players. You're checking in with them every day. Your coaching staff, making sure they're okay. It's almost like a family business. You know, you're responsible for all these things and you have all these different assets and all these different great kids in your program that you want to take care of and make sure that they have everything they need from an academic and athletic standpoint to be successful. And you're judged off how your student athletes do both on and off the court. So you have all these different things that you have to be responsible for. And that you just don't understand that as much until you get into the shoes of this role.
Was there anything specifically that you found that helped you juggle all of that? Like meditation, working out, anything?
Yeah, honestly, the self-health element is huge. And I didn't do a good enough job probably. But when you could take if you could take a step away and go exercise for an hour, you know, make sure you eat 3 square meals a day, you know, things like that, that sound kind of corny, but in reality, like they really matter. When I would do that, on some sort of schedule, I would feel a lot better. And when I wouldn't, I would feel worse. It was pretty, pretty much like clockwork that would happen. So it's a balance. And I feel like once I felt more comfortable, with the experiences, I would be able to kind of plan my schedule out a little better and I'd be able to balance everything. And that made it so I was a little more comfortable in the way we operated.
Gotcha. So then obviously you guys had a ton of success and a great first year building off what you guys did, you know, under Coach Smith.
Sure.
You know, was that, I guess handling that success probably isn't that big of a deal. You're just caught up in your team, but I'm just thinking back to watching you guys battle Gonzaga in the tournament, and Dickie V is giving you all kinds of praise, which is awesome. It was awesome to see. As somebody who's known you for years, but you know, what is that like on your end?
Yeah, it was, I mean, and kind of what we talked about before, you know, going into the season, a big part of it for me was like, shoot, I just hope we're able to have, you know, good success. You know, I want to be able to carry the torch really that Kyle, you know, started. And honestly, Kyle, as you know, Kyle's a really good coach, man. Those are big, big shoes to fill. You know, taking that position and keeping things going forward. But you know, once we got going in our spring and summer workouts, I felt like we'd have a chance to be good. And a lot of that was the continuity of our team. We lost 3 really good players that were impactful, But we brought back five or six guys that played a lot of minutes and that really had been in our program for a couple of years. So they knew what we thought was important and what they needed to execute and what they needed to do. And really the credit should go to our players because they were super coachable. You know, we did a few things a little different this past year and they never balked about it. They never, you know, questioned, you know, why are we making these changes? Why are we doing it? They just went out and hooped and they were coachable and really a joy to be around. And, you know, once we got in that flow and that rhythm, I think, you know, they were confident as well. And we just kind of fed off each other. And, you know, we didn't beat Gonzaga, obviously. We had a couple cracks at him this year. But we kind of feel like as a program, we're at the point now where we got to start, you know, knocking those guys off. We got it when we get them at home next year. Like we had them down 8 at halftime this year at home. We had a lead with a minute 50 to go. We got to finish that game. We got to get to the finish line. And for me, I hope, you know, once we get them one time, it'll be like when I was at St. Mary's my redshirt freshman year when we beat them, where, all right, now we know we can do it. Let's keep that thing going. And I think we won 3 out of 4 through the rest of my career there. So we didn't beat Gonzaga. We didn't beat St. Mary's. We've had good success against BYU. We beat them 3 out of the last 4 times. But the top of this league is insane, and it's a challenge to be able to knock those guys off.
Was it weird going against Randy Bennett, standing across the sidelines from him?
Super weird. You know, it wasn't at home. It wasn't as big of a deal. It was our first league game. We were coming off a really tough overtime game against Harvard. So I just didn't even worry about that piece. But going into Moraga and playing in McKeon was different. You know, it was really strange, and it kind of brought things full circle for me. You know, I guess it's 2020. So it was, you know, 12, 13 years ago when I was finishing my career there as a player. And to kind of be on the other sideline and be looking down and seeing Randy there was just something that I didn't necessarily think I would experience at this point. But it was definitely weird. Again, like I would love to beat him. We got to knock him off next year. And then we'll see if he's as nice to me before and after the games as was this year.
Right. Okay, Todd, obviously this offseason has been unprecedented and crazy in so many ways. Yeah. Starting with coronavirus and then more recently, you know, everything going on with George, starting with George Floyd and bringing to light all the social injustices that go on in our society and racial inequities.
Right.
And you've done something really cool here and you've helped start the Coaches Coalition for Progress. Talk to us a little bit about that and you know, how it started, what it is, how people can get involved.
Yeah, appreciate you asking about it. As we all know, you know, the last couple weeks, even last month, have been like just a really tense time. And I think a lot of people, especially, you know, just white males, are trying to find ways or we're curious to find a way to do our part and help, you know, in whatever form or fashion that might be. And so, you know, a lot of people were going to Twitter and posting messages and things of that nature. And I think it's all really important. And I thought that was great. But where I was struggling was like, I didn't want it to come off as just checking a box, you know, like, hey, I posted this message in solidarity with some of my players or some of my coworkers or friends. And I wanted to do something where we could say, hey, you know, yes, obviously we stand in solidarity specifically with, you know, our minority friends, our African Americans. But, you know, we are also want to create some tangible change and create some tangible progress. So one of my assistant coaches, Vinny McGee, is a young man that grew up here in Oakland, and his fiance, and he came over for dinner a couple weekends ago. And we were sitting down with my wife and we were just spitballing, you know, we were just like, hey, you know, what can we do? What, you know, how can we really promote change or promote progress without just kind of relying on a social media post to say we did our part? And that got me thinking like, hey, let's try to raise some money and help underserved youths in different areas. You know, kids who might not have athletic and academic equipment to put themselves in positions to be successful as they grow up in whatever setting they grow up in. And so that got us talking like, hey, you know, also let's try to find a way to unite people. And coaches, I think, have a unique platform. And for a lot of us, we are a lot more comfortable in this time because we've been around people that don't look like us, whether it's with white people and black people or black people and white people. We've in our basketball world has been, it's been a melting pot forever. And athletics and basketball specifically give us a vehicle where everybody is equal. You know, the score starts 0-0 every night when you tip off the game. It doesn't matter what you look like or how tall you are or how high you can jump. And so that got me started thinking, like, coaches can really help bring people together. Like, that's what we do every day. You know, we have guys from Europe and we have guys from LA or guys from San Francisco, whatever it may be. And everybody comes from a different background. And it's our job to get everybody on the same page and try to compete together to win. And my thought was similar to that. Like, as coaches, let's get together and let's start doing that. Let's start bringing people together. And I think my issue with social media is that it's just super divisive at times. And you know, I think that people want you to pick a side and say, hey, you know, if you're not this, you're that. And if you're not that, you're this. And for me, I wanted everybody to come together and say, we can get on board with supporting, you know, young kids who and try to give them better means to be successful. And then the other element of our coalition, and again, this is happening just kind of organically, is we want to provide a platform for, our young men in our program to have encounters with community leaders, whether it's our public safeties on campuses or law enforcement in the community, and have them be able to just come together, communicate in a non-volatile environment where, you know, it's not, you know, in a situation where everybody's tense, right? And one of the things that one of my players said, which really stuck with me, was that he had never, you know, he's 20 years old. He's a minority kid. Never once been in trouble, 3.3 GPA, a perfect kid. And what he said to me was, I've never had a positive interaction with a police officer. And to me, that stuck with me as saying, like, well, we're not doing enough then to provide those opportunities, because this is a young man that everybody should be proud of. And I think any law enforcement would be proud of this young man, what he's done as a student and as a basketball player. And so again, we're trying to just use our platforms as coaches to bring people together, to try to cut out some of the divisiveness in the world right now and see if, you know, we have a couple different missions, but just to see if we can make this world a better place.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I appreciate you taking action and helping put together this organization. And like you said, it's great. You know, it really is, not to belittle, like, when people go to social media to post a message of solidarity, that is meaningful. Sure. But certainly, you know, taking that extra step and what you guys are doing with the Coaches Coalition for Progress is a huge and much needed step. So we appreciate you for doing that. How can people get involved with it?
Yeah. So it's basically what I kind of talk to the other founding members about when we got it going was, like, let's kind of let this thing grow slowly. We wanted to see who actually truly wanted to help. You know, we've reached out a little bit, but there's been a lot of people reaching out to us saying, hey, like, this sounds great. Like, what can we do to be a part of it? You know, what do you envision with it? And just the long and the short of it is, for coaches, we have a $50 membership fee per year, and all those proceeds go to the athletic and academic equipment to give to, you know, these young kids in underserved communities. So that's where that money will go. And then we kind of ask people who join our program as coaches to take on our vision for uniting. I'll share our website. And if you want to send it out to your members, that'd be great. But just they got to be on the same page of bringing people together. And like, one of the things that we as a program are doing here that we're going to ask members to do is get your student athletes out in the community more as well. Like, we've done stuff here on campus at USF my last couple of years with clinics on campus and everything like that. But again, like, that's just not enough. What I'm going to ask of my student athletes is to go with me to some of these communities to do clinics in the community, where I think it'll carry a lot of weight and it'll give provide a lot of hope to some of these young kids to see, hey, maybe this young man came from a similar background to me, and now he's in the position where he's getting his college paid for because he went to school in high school, did a good job, and his basketball talents provided that opportunity. Now maybe we can get that young man on that same track as opposed to him going down another avenue because he doesn't have any leadership to look forward to or any role models to look up to. But getting our young men into the communities, I think, is important, as well as ourselves. And so just for these coaches who want to be a part of it, it's obviously going to take, it's going to take some time and some dedication to do it, but that's what real change is, right? And that's how we're going to keep this thing going for more than just a week or a month. And hopefully for, you know, longevity for multiple years down the road is by getting people to commit to actually doing some of these things. So on our website, and we're going to get a newsletter out here in the next week or two of kind of like steps of action that we would expect members to take part in. And the other thing that I think is, you know, unique and important to talk about is that we want all coaches to be a part of this. This isn't just, obviously we want a lot of college basketball coaches, but one of my great friends from high school who now coaches football at Washington State, his name is AJ Cooper. He's going to be a part of this. I would love women's coaches to be a part of it. I'd love high school coaches to be a part of it. I think the broader outreach that we can have, that'll just provide more of an opportunity for true progress and true change. So, you know, we're going to let it grow slowly and organically. And as we get everything a little more buttoned up, then we're going to start reaching out to some, you know, NBA people, some big time coaches, and see if they're willing to be a part of it and spread the word as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So the website is coachescoalitionforprogress.org. $50 to become a member. That money goes to academic and athletic equipment and materials for underserved communities.
Yeah, and just kind of as a way to pay homage to the way we started it, the first organization that we're going to work with is the Boys and Girls Club in West Oakland. And that's where my assistant, Vinny McGee, he grew up in West Oakland, went to McClymonds High School. And that was a place for him growing up that he knew he could go to and for lack of a better term, was a safe space. You know, he could go there, he could play basketball. You know, they had a couple computers for the children to work on for their classwork and things like that. And that's what we want to give back and make sure that they have those means to provide to the next wave of young children that are growing up in that area. So for the next Vinny McGee who's coming up, he can think of that place as the same kind of safe space. And hopefully that can propel them to become as successful as Vinny has now, being, you know, a 30-year-old assistant coach in the WCC who's able to provide for his family. And I think once we get this thing going and more people understand what we're doing, I think we'll get some really, really good traction.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys are already off to a great start. And again, man, it's been a while since we've caught up, but been super proud of seeing, you know, the success on the court, but to see what you're doing off the court as well this off season during a really critical time in our country is even better. So kudos to you, my man.
It's great seeing you, man. I appreciate it. And it's great catching up, and I'm around. So reach out whenever you want to catch up. And if there's anything the Dons can ever do for you, just let me know.
Yeah. Thanks again, Todd. Again, coachescoalitionforprogress.org. Go visit, become a member. $50 will go a long way. Thanks again, Todd.
Yeah. Take care, brother. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Quick reminder to please subscribe, write us a review, and visit our website at risingcoaches.com.